live from the internet, he is a modern day Johnny Utah. It's time to speak some English with Andrew English.
I am an FBI agent.
Whoa! Wait,
no, no, I'm not. I'm a podcaster, and I'm here to talk about soccer with you fine gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi, Wes. Hi, Carl. Cool. So now that we've gotten those introductions out of the way with,
I feel like
I think that's a good way to put it. You know, I mean, it's the most useless part of the whole ordeal.
It's really true.
Honestly, that's a little bit, I feel like that's playing down the uselessness of the rest of the podcast.
Was that maybe a little bit dismissive of y'all? I didn't intend that to be the case, but.
No, not at all. I'm not insulted.
Okay.
I just object to the idea that any one section of the podcast is much more useless than another.
Well, I mean, realistically, I don't know where I'm going with that. I don't want to disparage our podcast. I love our podcast.
And I love you, Andrew.
I love you too, Wes. But what I love most of all is the fact that the U.S. got perhaps the best draw that a U.S. team has ever gotten in the World Cup. And I'm super excited about it. We're drawn alongside England, Algeria, and Slovenia. And my thinking is that the game against England will be tough, but it's a theoretically winnable game. Not necessarily on the form England are on right now, but you never know come World Cup time. And Algeria and Slovenia. Both.
Somebody's going to break a metatarsal. You know that, first off. And right now, England doesn't really have any center backs. They're all hurt.
Well, it's like right now. It's like, I mean, this right, what the injury problems right now are not very relevant to what's going to happen this summer. I mean,
right.
Unless it's a long-term injury, I'd argue that for some guys, it's better to be hurt now and not play that much this spring and just be coming back into it come World Cup time. And that may not be great for their clubs, but it might get them a few good games in the World Cup.
I agree with you completely. I think the worst part about the World Cup is that you get a bunch of guys, especially the elite team. I mean, I think part of the reason the World Cup play can be so ragged sometimes is any player worth half a damn is exhausted by the time he gets there.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, especially these days. I mean, the regular season butts right up against the World Cup, and it kind of levels the playing field a little bit. I mean, it means teams like Algeria and like Slovenia that don't have big name club players, teams that might have a lot of players warming benches, are actually going to have fresher squads than the big guys.
I agree with that.
That said, I mean, I really think that if the U.S. does not make it out of the group stages in this World Cup, considering the draw we've been given, it has to be classified as a tremendous failure, I think.
Yeah, indefensible. I mean, I think that getting out of the group stages should always be.
If it's indefensible, you're disagreeing with it.
I think it's indisputable, personally. But,
no, I think it's indispensable.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like you have to throw out the record book when the USA and Algeria play, you know?
That is very true. I mean, Algeria got past Egypt to get this far, and Egypt is definitely a solid team. I mean, we saw what they did against Brazil earlier this year. So the fact that that the Algerians actually managed to make it through says a lot about them, but not really enough for me. I'm really, really interested to see how Bob Bradley approaches this World Cup, because this is do or die time for him. He's had a lot of time in charge of this team, ups and downs, and consistency really, really has not been their strong suit. I'm going to be curious to see if he makes any interesting changes, if he gives some chances to young players who maybe haven't gotten.
Thing is, he's going to have to. I mean, when you look at the U.S. roster, you look at they have serious questions at forward now, considering that thanks to the tragic accident in Washington, D.C., the best option for the U.S. at forward is either Clint Dempsey, who plays – I guess he's playing more forward this year, so he's not a bad option. But the true – the best true forward on the roster is a 19-year-old. And then you go, there is no left back. There are, in fact, no fewer than three individuals trying to be the left back, and none of them has locked it down, one of which has only just recently naturalized. And then you've got one of the central defenders hasn't played, has been hurt, and will just be coming off of major knee surgery before the World Cup starts. His primary backup saw action for the first time in 3 months this weekend after suffering a bizarre eye infection. I mean,
I missed that completely, actually.
Yeah, Jay Demerit. Wow. Jay Demerit got a weird eye infection and missed a lot of time. And then you've got, I mean, the midfield's all right, but you know, you've got who's going to be the DM? Is it Ricardo Clark? Is it Michael Bradley? Is what's his face, the German, ever going to, what's Jermaine Jones? Just naturalized going to get healthy and play. What about Marisa Du? What about Freddie? There are a lot of question marks. I mean, we've got a 33-year-old with 12 caps to his name that might make the World Cup squad.
It's a little bit of a ragtag bunch, I'm not going to lie. But I feel like there's more consistent quality throughout this squad than there was in the 2006 World Cup. I don't know. It's going to depend in large part on who's healthy. And I feel like it really hurts the U.S. that Charlie Davies isn't going to be available to us, because he was – even though he wasn't scoring a ton of goals, he was doing all of the right things. He was always
scored in Mexico City, which is
a hard thing to do.
Right. You're right, and I think that it also had – there's the weird phenomenon of not only losing him hurt on the field because of what he brought to the team, the element, but I feel like they had just gotten to the hype point with him where we were set at forward finally because of the Davies-Altidore partnership, and we didn't have to worry about that position because of Davies and Altidore. And I feel like the team and the fans and everything around it had kind of gelled around the idea of this partnership. And now I think, you know, all of a sudden you've got a 19-year-old Jose Altidore that has to cope with, you know, the immediate reaction was, well, Jose better step up, you know? And he's just this 19-year-old kid that's kind of played sparingly, and he's gotten more playing time lately. And he was supposed to be, you know, one half of a partnership, and now he's going to have to spend the next however many months listening to, you know, who's going to play with Jose rumors.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like having him up front by himself is not necessarily the worst option in the world, because I feel like between Michael Bradley, Landon Donovan, Clint Dempsey, we have guys that we can throw in just behind the striker to support pretty effectively.
You risk a lot, though, asking a 19-year-old player to be a target man at the World Cup. I mean, that's it takes a certain level of refinement. And one thing that Jose has actually struggled with in his game to this point is his ability as a hold-up man. He has not done well with his back to the goal to this point. He certainly had shown promise. But, you know, if you put him up there alone, he's going to have to keep the ball at some point and distribute. And he has not proven that he's really technical enough at this point to be relied upon to, you know, bring down a long ball, shrug off a defender, and then hit, you know, Donovan or Dempsey or Bradley or whomever's coming late.
I still think, though, that giving him the shot to try, because he did in the Confederations Cup do a better job of it than maybe he's doing at Hull, but I haven't seen him play very much at Hull. I just remember in the Confederations
Cup. Yeah, now that Hull's not on ESPN every week.
He did a good job of it, but I feel like giving him the chance to do it is still the best option we have.
I don't know. I think that moving Clint Dempsey up is the best option we have. I've not been
– But see, I don't feel like he doesn't score his goals from like an off-the-shoulder running in kind of striker. I mean, he scores more of the behind-the-big-guy striker type of goals even when he
– Well, then put him in the hole. Plays. The old shadow striker.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I think we already were sort of suggesting.
Well, he's played on the left wing.
He hasn't. I don't think he's a good option on the wing, personally. And actually, that's where I'm most concerned about our squad. I don't necessarily feel like we have the depth, the speed, the creativity in either of the wing positions to really be able to effectively challenge defenders of some of the bigger teams. I think that that's going to be one of the biggest challenges that we face. I definitely think that Dempsey can play up front if necessary. I mean, we've seen him do it before, and he can be effective. But I think his best role is, as Carl said, it's going to be as kind of like a second striker, somebody coming in.
Well, and I guess let me clarify that is I guess what I meant by not a midfielder.
Well, I mean, why not do something kind of like Barcelona does with Donovan, Altidore, and Dempsey with three strikers, kind of like. A big guy and two kind of like
the problem,
shadow strikers. I mean,
in a perfect world, I agree. My problem with that formation, Carl, is you're putting a lot of pressure on a defense where, you know, best case scenario, Oguchi Onyewu is just barely healthy enough to. I mean, you're putting a lot of pressure defense.
That's actually not true because that formation actually allows you to play more central midfielders, which gives you the ability to bolster the defense. Because you're playing with three attacking players, and then you kind of – it gets rid of the problem with the wingers because you don't really have wingers in that formation. So you're actually kind of denser in the middle and not maybe as thick in attack but just utilizing purely what you have.
Hmm. I mean, I think for an extremely talented squad, that's a great formation to play because I agree with everything you're saying about how it sort of bolsters up the midfield. And I think that you see – I think the midfielders see a lot more action in those sorts of formations. I'm not entirely sure that we have
the talent or the
speed to really make that work. I mean, that's one of the things that makes Barcelona's formation so effective.
We're not going to be as good as Barcelona, but maybe we could beat Slovenia and Algeria that way.
Okay. And I mean That is the primary concern, so I will cede that to you for sure.
The interesting thing to me about the U.S. roster is the sort of the there are very few like universally rounded players. So the interesting thing about the U.S. roster is if you're looking at for instance taking the midfield, our best midfielder is Landon Donovan. But Landon Donovan is also our best right winger, is also our best, you know, attacking midfield. He is better in, you know, various positions, and he's also slight, and he's not particularly defensive. And then you take a look at Bradley, who is more physically rounded and certainly has offensive flair, but is not great defensively at this point. And then you take a guy like Ricardo Clark, who's got a great work rate, pretty decent defensively, but couldn't pass his way out of a cardboard box. And then you've got, you know, Jose Francisco Torres, who's extremely creative but tiny. And it's just interesting in that, you know, we don't have the luxury of having that one, you know, do-all sort of play.
I think that almost points back right at the formation I'm suggesting because that allows you to play all three of those guys at the same time. The defensive one, the sort of medium physically kind of attacking one and the creative.
So who are your three central mids?
The three guys were Clark, Bradley, and what's this last guy you mentioned? Torres?
Torres.
I think either Clark or Edu could play it reasonably.
If Edu is healthy is the problem. He's coming back from a knee injury.
If Edu's healthy, but I think that he's going to be healthy by the time the World Cup rolls around. Either one of those guys can do a serviceable job in the defensive capacity in midfield. And then I think that you've got options aside from that. I mean, I think if you put Michael Bradley and either Torres or Clayston, who's been kind of on and off for him, admittedly, if you put those guys in the midfield alongside Adu or
Clayston Clark, looks like a date rapist.
And that's a reason not to play him.
I feel like you can't have a date rapist.
Here's the thing, though. No. When Clayston is on his game, I think
now,
that he's
by his
most...
game, are we talking about date rape or soccer? You're,
no, because, we're talking
roofies
about
are very
soccer.
Effective in any sort of athletic competition.
Hey, If honestly, we roofied the shit out of Slovakia or Slovenia, we'd have a really good shot.
His ass can sit on the bench the entire time for all I care, as long as he's got the roofies to make this happen. But
that
failing that,
would show up in the locker room.
Failing that, if he actually shows up on the pitch, I think that he might be the most effective passer in the U.S. squad. I think that he has the vision to actually be able to carve out some chances that you're not necessarily going to see with coming from Michael Bradley. I mean, Torres, I haven't seen enough of Torres to definitively be able to say one way or another what the situation is with him. I know that he is a very creative player, and I know that he does have some passing ability. But for my money, if Clayston is healthy and if he is on form, I think that he could actually be a fairly integral part of our
I disagree. I think Clayston is the classic case of a decent to good domestic player that had – I think he's a lot like Eddie Johnson. I think he's better than Eddie Johnson, but I think he had a great run of form. He had a couple of really big games that weren't – you know, he had the hat trick. Was it a friendly against Sweden? Was it when he had his hat trick? But
yeah, I think so.
I feel like he may be there. I don't feel like – I would rather have Torres. Torres in legitimate call-ups in – and granted it's CONCACAF, but in the only competitive game – in the only, you know, real competitive games that the U.S. has had, Torres has been a good source of control in the midfield. My only problem is – I know that you want to put Donovan as one of the front three. I worry that if you put him too far up the field, it screws up the U.S. transition because I don't see anybody else on the roster that can really competently carry the ball.
Well, the thing that formation lets Dempsey and Donovan do is whatever they want. And so Donovan just gets free reign to run around and be a part of the transition. I mean, they don't have, like, specific, like, I mean, they kind of both act as wingers and as forwards and do kind of whatever comes. I just think that it allows them to both do what comes naturally to them. And, I mean, that's really what we need to do is find the way to let our best players, the most talent we have, do the most natural things they can. And, I mean, that's how we get them to perform the best. And I feel like, so, that little sort of triangle up top is more about just like letting Donovan and Dempsey have freedom.
I just feel like we're not I feel like to run that formation, your three top players have to be dangerous.
Well then, I mean,
and I like Dempsey. I am a Dempsey fan, and I think that Altidore is going to be great, and I think that Donovan is very good, but I don't feel like the three of them I would be more comfortable with a 4-4-2.
I mean, I guess we already said that we don't really have any wingers. So why are we going to play, like, some really shitty wingers?
I didn't say that we don't have any wingers. I think that Stuart Holden has proven that he should be at least given a chance to become the left – or the – what is it? He plays right. The right wing on the squad. I think he has – I would rather – if the best-case scenario is Stuart Holden shows enough in the coming months to allow Bradley to push Dempsey further up the field.
Because, like, I don't think you need a huge amount of creative ability like Barcelona have to be able to do that, to do the three up top.
No, I'm not saying creative, but I'm just saying that I don't – even at this point, I don't feel like Dempsey is a consistent goal scorer. I don't feel like Altidore is there yet.
Well, since none of them are, it by having three of them there gives all of them a better chance to do it.
I don't know.
Instead of just playing like, I mean, because up top, Dempsey up top on Dempsey, it's because
I would put him
like
right
Dempsey
behind
Altidore. But then it's like, then he is just doing the same thing. And then Donovan's on one of the wings.
Yeah.
So
I think Donovan
left
plays
winger.
He plays in from the left. And then you have, hopefully, a guy like Stuart Holden, a traditional wide winger on the right side. And Donovan's cutting in from the left. You've got a true winger on the right. You have Altidore up front.
Donovan cutting in from the left with Dempsey right behind Altidore turns into the exact same thing I'm proposing, except with a right winger instead of another central midfielder. So it's like less defensive.
He's less of a forward, is what I'm saying. Less of a true forward.
I don't think that
three forwards is. No, I don't think that three forwards is the way to go.
Because since he's not left-footed, he's just going to drift inside, and he's just
going to
do...
Yes, he is.
Donovan? He's always been right-footed.
I think he's a lefty.
No, I'm pretty sure he's not. I'm pretty sure that Donovan is right-footed.
Every single player I've ever seen, a right-footed player put out left, like who's like Donovan, they just always end up playing like another shadow striker.
Well,
or is he ambidextrous?
Might be. He's always played on the left. I guess I just assumed. He is more withdrawn. When you say three up top, I picture three strikers, three forwards, and I think that is too aggressive.
Oh, no, I don't really mean
that. That's kind of not – I don't think that's what he's talking about. I think that the idea there is that whoever's playing at – whichever players are out on the right and the left are sort of going to be transitional players from midfield up to the attack. They can join the attack when necessary, but they're also going to drop back. They're going to have defensive responsibilities. And I guess I sort of agree thinking about that now that Altidore is maybe a little too young, a little too inexperienced to be able to handle that on his own. But we still have Brian Ching in the squad. And quite honestly, even though Brian Ching is not a great goal scorer, Brian Ching is excellent as a hold-up man.
Yep, he is.
I think that could actually be a pretty solid option if we went that route. Unfortunately, I don't think that nothing that I've seen from Bob Bradley suggests to me that he's going to get particularly creative with his tactics or with his squad selection.
You're right.
No.
For the World Cup. I think that we're probably going to see a 4-4-2 in some form or fashion, pretty straightforward. I'm not entirely sure that that's going to get the job done.
I agree with that. But I think it should be enough at least for us to get out of the group.
I feel like that maximizes the squad. And I know that it's dowdy and conservative and boring, but I feel like that is the best possible use of the talent available.
Honestly, I'd like to see us use a different formation maybe in every game, depending on which players are the freshest and who played the best in the previous and like actually played in a situation.
I just don't. That's not Bradley's strength.
No,
I mean, unfortunately, Bradley's strength is getting the guys to play the formation.
You know what the U.S. team needs? They need the rotation formation.
They do need the rotation formation.
If they would adopt the rotation formation, I think that they would be set.
Well, it would solve the left back problem because Tim Howard would be running up to play left back.
Right, exactly. Curious, do you guys know what has happened at this point with Edgardo Castillo?
Yeah, he's natural. He's ready to. He played in the Denmark friendly.
Okay, fantastic.
Actually, Bradley played him as a left wing in the Denmark friendly for about 10 minutes, which was odd. But that's what I was talking about. One of the more interesting positional battles on the U.S. squad is right now. It's sort of we have two mediocre left backs with track records, and then we got the new guy. And so although in reality it's four deep, the classic left battle. The left back battle for the U.S. men's national team is down to Jonathan Bornstein, Heath Pierce, Jonathan Spector, and Edgar Castillo. And we've got two guys that in Bornstein and Pierce, we've got two guys that have alternated between being very good for the national team and being very bad for the national team. In Spector, we have a guy that is playing out of position, but, you know, is better than a bad Bornstein or a bad Pierce. And then we've got a minuscule Lilliputian New Mexican that has recently switched allegiances from Mexico to the old U.S. of A. So I feel like whomever wins that battle could act. Or and then actually, sorry, it's five deep because theoretically, if enough people get healthy, you also could slot Carlos Bocanegra back there if you just want to, you know, not score or not have any sort of offense from that position.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Bocanegra might actually be our best option back there if we possibly against England, and maybe if we get later into the competition once we're facing
Bradley's consistently. Whenever we're in, you can always tell if the U.S. is playing a difficult team because he throws what's his face Bocanegra at left back.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're all uniquely limited. Bocanegra, they all play in one. Bocanegra only plays in one direction. Bornstein really only plays in one direction. Castillo really only plays in one direction. And Pierce is just so inconsistent, you can't figure out what he's going to do from game to game.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I feel like when Pierce is on his game, he's the best option we have back there. But you just never know who's going to show up when he's on the field. I mean, he's a huge, huge liability when he is not playing well. And unfortunately,
enough of the time that you have to worry about it.
Yep.
And then he's also had a move. You know, he had a move in Europe that went sour, and he kind of had to resurrect it with a trip back to the old MLS. And so playing time is going to be an issue. I mean, that's going to be an issue with a lot of the core U.S. players, is you're going to have guys that have, you know, not participated as much with their teams.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked for half an hour or so about the U.S. team. Should we talk about who's actually going to win the World Cup?
I think that we've already discussed this at length, Carl. It's clearly going to be Brazil.
I know you've wanted to talk about it again.
I do, because I feel like we have the best. We have the best system.
And is Andrew aware of our system?
I think I've missed out on the system entirely. Why don't you explain it to me and to all listeners out there?
Only seven teams have ever won a World Cup. So only seven teams are initially qualified for contention.
Because nobody wins it for the first time anymore. That's just not –
that never
crap.
Happens. That's true.
I'm assuming you're automatically disqualifying Uruguay then.
No, Uruguay's won several times, dog.
No, but unfortunately, Uruguay passes – now, Wes is more keen on Uruguay than I am, but Uruguay,
I think Uruguay is my dark horse.
Test, which is winning outside of your own country.
Yeah, you automatically disqualify. So the first category, the first qualification. We'll just start. So the first qualification, Andrew English, is you have to have won before, because everything is so convoluted and twitchy now that you cannot get away with it. We decided
that the World Cup is now all emotional, and that the emotional edge that comes from not having to prove that you can win it is ultimately what determines who wins it.
Because you got to stay cool. You got to be calm.
Because it's all these bullshit one-off games and, like, penalty kicks. And so anyway, as Wes was saying –
You throw it out. If you've never won it before, you're done. You're toast. You're through. Nobody cares.
But then only a few of those countries have actually won outside of their country.
So you got to knock off France. You got to knock off England. You got to cancel. You got to cancel. I believe one of Argentina's wins happened in.
They won
in Mexico as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying you got to knock off one of them.
But you got to knock off. But we didn't really count wins, because remember, we disqualify Argentina for another reason later on.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So that disqualifies England and France. And so then it's down to
Uruguay?
Germany. Yeah, Uruguay, Italy. Brazil, Argentina, Italy, and Germany. Argentina is disqualified for the Maradona factor.
Yeah, dude, God hates him. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, Maradona is not going to coach a team to win the World Cup. We all know that.
That's not going to happen. It's not possible.
No. He's an idiot.
And he responded to their barely making the World Cup with an expletive-laden tirade so severe that he was banned from several World Cup events, including the draw.
Yeah.
Which effectively means that only four countries can win the World Cup.
So we got Brazil, Italy, Germany, and my boys, Uruguay.
That's it.
All right.
So those are the minimum number. The winner will be one of those four teams.
Yep. Well, and obviously among those four teams, Brazil and Italy are far and away the strongest. And I would say that at this point, Brazil kind of
Brazil,
at least on paper, leaves the rest of those teams in the dust.
But actually, I you know what the X factor is?
What's that?
One of Uruguay's World Cup wins was in Brazil. So I think that gives them the mental edge. It was in Brazil. It was over Brazil.
So they're also Southern Hemisphere experts.
So I feel like it's going to come down to Uruguay and Brazil, and you know you got to go with the track record.
Well, but you see though the other and maybe slightly bigger X factor here, maybe the Y, let's call it the Y factor, maybe the Z factor is that in the World Cup is the most immune to X factors and bullshit. And of all of the world sporting competitions, the favorite always wins in the World Cup. I mean, not always, but is more likely to win than any other major team competition I can think of.
Yep.
Nothing surprising happens in the World Cup, really. If you take the teams that actually can win.
No, I mean, I'm looking down the winner, and the joke, even though it was, you know, Uruguay has won twice, but they won back when they were good at soccer in, like, 1930 and 1950.
I know.
If you look down, I mean, even if you look at the runners-up, you see a lot of Netherlands, a lot of Germany. You know, Germany's been runners-up, if you count West Germany, four times. Italy's been runners-up a couple of times. Hungary made an appearance, but that was back when they were the marvelous Magyars. And so you're right. There is no that you have to go back to 1930 when the United States finished third to really see somebody in the top four that did. I guess the Korean Republic. Although no, because they got the home team advantage. So I mean, really skimming the list, you know, Korea. Turkey in 2002, which was a weird cup, Bulgaria in 94, and then, you know, the U.S. in 1930 are the only teams I can look at to finish, you know, inside of the top four that I would have, you know, not have, you know, if you would take any other team on the entire top four list, I bet I you know.
You can make a solid argument that they should have won the cup.
Yeah, I mean, Poland appears a couple of times, but it's in the 70s, and Poland was kind of important then. And, you know, Bulgaria sneaks in, but it was, you know, back when it was post-communist bloc. And, they, you know, but, yeah, it's mostly the Italys and the Germanys and Portugal a couple of times. And, yeah.
I guess we forgot to mention the potential home team advantage, which is still real. That is how France won its first cup 12 years ago.
Because FIFA cheats.
But South Africa is not good enough to win the World Cup.
And they'll advance out of the group stage, though. I'm calling it.
I do not think they will. I think that France and Mexico are coming out of that group. I know that France isn't that great right now, but I think regardless of how bad a coach Raymond Domenech is, I think that France has the talent to be able to.
It's not about talent, though, Drew. It's about FIFA tinkering and poor refereeing. And is anybody going to have any sympathy if in a crucial game with a berth in the group stage hanging in the balance, if South Africa gets a call and France does not? People will fucking applaud that. North Korea made the semifinals. North Korea, what, they beat Portugal en route to – I mean, North Korea had
South Korea?
Sorry. No, yeah. Sorry, the Korean Republic. I apologize.
This has got to be North Korea's first World Cup.
I believe it is.
Sorry, when they were the host nation, South Korea advanced farther than they had any right to.
Oh, definitely.
And the host team always advances out of the group stage. So I'm telling you, I think that that's going to continue. I think that that's the way the tournament's built. I think that they get just enough of a nudge from the crowd. I'm not saying it's going to be rigged, but – you know, overwhelmed officials. FIFA's going to make sure that a shaky official gets put into a key game that features South Africa, which is going to lead to craziness, and either Mexico or France, and I'm betting France because they've got some bad karma coming their way. I'm betting France doesn't get a call.
I mean, that's you put together a good scenario.
I just feel like there's going to be. You know, think you're the like 40-year-old ref. You're out of shape, but you love soccer, and you're tired of getting yelled at in French. And all you can think about is that goal going in against Ireland and, you know, all the pressure. What a bunch of jackasses. And, you know, maybe there's a tug in the box. Maybe there's not. But, you know, you don't know. So you just don't call it. It's not like there's replay or anything.
What if the IRA bombs the French bus?
Dude, the IRA should get back together and bomb the French bus.
I think that's the best plan. Really throw a wrench into things.
If they put a bomb in the ball and ensure that France wins the kickoff, and then when Thierry Henry goes to play the ball to start the game, it explodes. And the shrapnel hits four players, and so France has to make three substitutions and then leave William Gallus on the field despite the fact that like a 6-inch piece of metal is sticking out of his forehead.
They have to bandage that up, Wes. You know, you can't bleed on the field.
They just put that glue stuff around it. The edge of the cut. You just leave it in there so it won't, you know, the wound won't bleed.
Well, clearly you've put a lot of thought into this.
I just feel like the fates have aligned.
You know,
why do you think the most obscure, you know, the most shady draw for a major tournament that I've ever seen just so happens to put a team that everybody hates into a group with the host nation? I mean, really? There's no metric for how FIFA does this. They say they base it, they use the most recent ratings as a guideline, which they say factor in like the last 3 years or the last two World Cups worth of performances and some other random crap. But it's staggering to me the coincidence that would put the team that, because really at this point, France is the most hated team in the world.
No, they have to.
Like, they've reached a status where even if you're a French soccer fan, you're like, yeah, they maybe got away with one.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think people are really going to think about it that much by World Cup time.
Oh, I think they will. I think there's going to be
I think Ireland's going to be frustrated, but nobody else will care anymore.
I think with secret urgings from FIFA, Ireland is going to embark upon a media campaign. And they're going to start showing. They're going to hire an ad agency and start showing clips of the Henry handball. And they're going to get anti-France fervor whipped up. And you know, it's freedom soccer, and you don't play with your hands. And
I think you're just way overthinking this whole situation. I think that if France doesn't make it out of the group stage, it will be entirely down to their coach. I think that there's no question in my mind about that. Obviously, France has the ability to make it through, but they've been playing far, far beneath themselves up to this point. And honestly, I think that if South Africa gets through, it's not necessarily going to be because of a win over France. I think that the most likely scenario for South Africa making it through is that they beat Mexico in their first game because they're riding high. It's the first game of the World Cup, and they kind of want to show what they can do.
Yeah.
And then they take it to Uruguay because dark horse or no.
No.
Uruguay
that group is going to come down to Uruguay and South Africa are getting out of that group. France is going to win a close game and self-destruct, and Mexico is also going to self-destruct.
Well, I honestly, I would love to see it play out that way, Wes. I will be thrilled if it actually turns out like that, because nothing would make me happier than seeing South Africa and Uruguay make it out, Mexico and France get out to the dust. I'm a pessimist. What can I say?
Well, in all fairness, I agree with you in reality, because you're right. Every group, there will be of all of the World Cup groups, so let's see, A through H, we're going to get the favorites out of every group I'm calling there are going to be 2 second place teams that are a little bit unusual.
All right.
So Group A, we've got South Africa, Mexico, Uruguay, and France. And like I said, I do think South Africa sneaks out. I think it's probably it's more likely to be at the expense of Mexico. So I'm going to say that group is France and South Africa.
I agree with that.
The next group, Argentina, Nigeria, Republic of Korea, and Germany. So it's going to be Nigeria and Argentina.
Greece is in that group.
Yes. Didn't I say Greece?
No, you said Germany.
Oh, I'm sorry, Greece. I apologize. So, you know, Korea and Greece, no shot.
You know, I honestly disagree. I think between Nigeria, South Korea, and Greece, it's a toss-up. I don't think Nigeria – I think you could get a mediocre Nigeria showing up to a couple of games against a Greece team who just happens to play strong, sneaks a goal, wins somehow.
I don't know. Greece back then.
I mean, Greece, it's been a couple of years since they took the Euros. I don't see that was just an abysmal game, except for seeing Cristiano Ronaldo crying, just breaking down in tears on the sidelines after that game. That really warmed my heart. But I don't think that Greece really has much of a shot. I think they'll be sound defensively, but I think ultimately they're not going to be able to score enough to make it through. I think that Wes is probably right about Argentina and Nigeria coming out of there, but South Korea and Nigeria, I will say, is pretty much a toss-up. I could see that going either way. And South Korea has some very talented players. This kid who's been playing for Bolton now, whose name I can't remember, probably something Lee or Lee
it's
something.
It's actually Bing Bong Mushu Gaipan.
Oh, right. Him.
He's a favorite player.
He's been excellent so far.
Yeah, he's spicy.
But yeah, I think that there's no big pointers either way between Nigeria or South Korea.
I think that Group C, the U.S.'s group, which is England, U.S., Algeria, and Slovenia, I think we're going to get an upset out of that group. When you combine the crazy emotional baggage of England with the wild inconsistency and positional upheaval of the United States, I don't know which one it's going to be. And if I had to bet, I would bet on England and USA coming through. But it would not shock me if either the U.S. or England managed to self-destruct and paved the way for, you know, Slovenia to back in.
I don't think if a team comes out of that group other than England and the U.S., it is not going to be Slovenia. Slovenia has one player of
– No, you're right. It would be Algeria if it was anybody else.
Yeah, and I think Algeria actually has a semi-legitimate shot to upset the U.S.
I just think you can never underestimate England or the United States' ability to pull defeat from the jaws of victory.
If it was a McLaren, an Englishman still at the helm in England, I would agree with you, but I don't think that Capello England is going to be that weak.
I think that he has instilled a lot of confidence and a lot of discipline in that team. I think that if England are not top of that group, it is a major, major shock. The way they've been playing recently, they've looked pretty much unbeatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I just feel like they're always one bad call or one Rooney metatarsal injury away from...
Not the Capello England. The Capello England is an entirely different beast.
We'll see.
Since the beginning.
We'll see.
He can adapt. And that's
and then
the
you've
thing.
Got you're right. And then you've got I think Group D is actually very interesting. Germany, Australia, Serbia, is it, and Ghana.
I agree.
Yep.
Because I don't think they're a sleeper in the sense of they're going to win the World Cup, but I think Australia is going to surprise people. And I think in Germany, Australia, and Ghana, you have three very good teams.
I think that I foresee Ghana coming out of that group along with Germany. Australia, I like, and I definitely think they have the capability to give any team in their group a rough time. And if Goose Hiddink was still in charge of Australia, I would consider them to be all but a lock to make it out of that group. But they're not the same team now as they were back in 2006. And I think that the fact that they don't have the same level of tactical mastermind behind the bench is gonna make a big difference. I mean, they did a great job in the 2006 World Cup, and I just don't necessarily see it happening again. But Tim Cahill is always a threat. They're pretty solid defensively. I mean, the A League has been improving pretty consistently in recent years. So I think that Australia and Ghana are gonna go toe to toe to see who comes out second in that group.
Yeah, I agree with that. The next group, I feel like E really kind of really signifies how this whole World Cup is sort of like the first seed, and then it falls off considerably, because I feel like I guess Cameroon's the favorite out of
Netherlands. Yeah, Netherlands, Denmark, Japan, and Cameroon.
It's got to be Netherlands and Cameroon. I don't see that going any other way.
Denmark is strong in almost every World Cup. I mean, not terribly strong, but I mean, this is a really lousy. I mean, Cameroon is not that great.
That's a lousy group.
No, I mean, here's the thing. Denmark, I think, might have more consistency throughout their squad overall than Cameroon does. But Cameroon on the attacking end of the field is going to be strong enough that that's going to shine through. I feel like if Eto doesn't just completely bomb out, then they're going to score enough goals to squeak out of that group. Japan, I don't foresee doing anything whatsoever.
Japan never does.
No. Remember what was it, Junichi Yamamoto, or that one really good Japanese guy that played in Italy for a while and then wound up in Scotland?
Nakajima? Well,
Nakatomi.
I think there's Nakata.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Nakata. Japan's doing nothing.
No,
they never do. F is easy, I think. Italy, Paraguay.
Yeah, we're not getting New Zealand, no, and Slovakia.
New Zealand will not score a goal this World Cup. New Zealand is terrible. I don't know how they made it in, except they play in.
They played Old Zealand.
Yeah.
Paraguay's not bad.
No, they're not bad at all.
No, in fact, Paraguay actually has some very talented attacking players. I could see them actually making a decent impression. I could see them maybe making the semifinal, depending on how things go for them. Oscar Cardozo, especially, is a very, very talented player.
And then in Group G, we got Brazil.
I think Ivory Coast goes over Portugal.
Do you really?
Yeah. I think they're the best African team.
I think that it's going to be hard to argue with that's a real tough one to call. I mean, this is the – if there's a group of death – If there's a group of death in this World Cup, that's it for sure. Tons of great Ivorian players, and I mean, any team that's got Drogba up front is always going to be a threat to score in any game.
But the key there is, do you think he's going to be healthy after a long season?
That's always a good question.
Here's the thing. Drogba, I feel like, especially for his age, he holds up very well. And it's rare that if he's on the pitch, he's not making a contribution. But Portugal has tons of depth, tons of technical skill, and if Ronaldo is on his game, then they've got the ability on that team to beat anybody. I don't think that I don't foresee them making it into the semifinals or the finals, but I have a hard time not seeing them at least making it out of the group. I think that for me, it's going to be Brazil and Portugal coming out of that group. But it's going to be interesting to see the way every one of those games shapes up that doesn't involve North Korea.
And then I also think the final group is also very, very non-interesting. Yeah. Spain, Switzerland is awful. Chile and Honduras – I think it will be interesting in that it will be a fight between Chile and Honduras, but I don't – it's kind of like
– I think they're all equally awful, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I disagree with that. I think that Switzerland is far and away worse than Chile and Honduras. Honduras has some solid players at every position. Figueroa is very good at the back. They've got Suazo up front. They've got Wilson Palacios, who's been doing a great job for Tottenham. I think that Honduras has some talent, and I've seen them play enough with my Honduran friend Tupac to feel confident saying that they can make it through. But I mean, Chile aren't slouches either.
I can see it's a lot easier to defend Honduras than it is Chile. I don't feel like Chile's really that great.
I love Chile.
You know, I think that Chile has some some strong players. Boy, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
But that's one of those race to lose in the second round games.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of which one of those teams comes out, it's not going to be
the winner. The second place team in that group will be worse than the third place team in Group G.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so now that we've done that, we probably should, because we're running somewhat low on time, move to the bottom of the table.
In fact, indeed.
All right, so
since Portsmouth won, didn't they beat Burnley over the weekend?
I don't know, maybe.
I think they did.
They did.
And
so, they did, you're right.
So now it's a lot closer between the three.
Portsmouth is still four points from safety. They took
an early season 6-pointer, which is there's something to be said for that. And I feel like they proved, and this is despite the fact that they're not getting paid right now. They get nothing. But they still showed up. They still won a game. Admittedly, it was against Burnley, who are far and away the worst away team in the league.
They're also going to finish in the bottom three.
They won a game. Wolves actually kind of shocked me that they beat Bolton. I really was not expecting that. They are probably still not going to do anything. I think four of the last five goals that Wolves have scored have all come from Jody Craddock, who I think had scored two goals in his entire Wolves career before he scored two goals in one game a couple of weeks ago. I don't think that he's going to – I don't think that a 34-year-old center back is going to really hold up for very long as in scoring threat. But right now he's getting the job done, so – hard to discount that.
Well, those 3 points, though, were exactly what Portsmouth needed out of that. It keeps it a little easier to climb out. And if Portsmouth gets a win, that moves them up to 18th, only 1 point behind safety.
Yep. See?
So
there you go.
Portsmouth's climbing out.
There you go. I think that actually right now the what we had pegged as the bottom three, I think there was some sort of clever name for it, though I can't recall at the time.
The SE bottom three.
The SE bottom three, that's right. I think that for at least two-thirds of the SE bottom three, this was a very productive week. Wolves and Portsmouth are both on their way to climbing out of that group, and Burnley is just dropping like a stone.
So are we rooting then for Burnley to fall into the relegation zone and for Wolves to come out?
Here's the thing. Wolves has to stay because they're part of the SE bottom three.
I am rooting for all of the SE bottom three to confound our prediction and survive. I don't want to see any of these teams go, but I just think that they're probably the most likely to go.
I want to see them all go. I want to be right.
Yeah, well, you know, you could be right, but you probably won't.
Then we would have to hold over to the next year, the SE bottom threes that survived.
Indeed.
It's true. It's true.
No, I would imagine we will have forgotten by the end of the season and claim whichever three teams get relegated as the SE bottom three.
We'll remember Portsmouth.
Because Portsmouth is still going to be at the bottom of the table.
Well, and Portsmouth has Avram Grant. He makes things.
We'll be like, oh, hey, there they are, right last again.
Proven wrong, Wes. Portsmouth is going to make it out. They're going to survive. Aruna Dindon is going to go on a scoring tear, and you won't know what hits you.
Yeah, I bet you $5 Aruna Dindon does nothing that resembles a scoring tear.
I'll take that bet.
All right.
I bet you I think we need to establish what qualifies as a scoring tear.
I feel like Carl needs to be the unimpassioned the moderator here. Carl, what would you consider a scoring tear? Like, it's got to be a legitimate scoring tear, not like a scoring tear for Aruna Dindon, which would be two shots almost on frame and a post.
No, I'm thinking like if he scores four goals by the middle of January.
Well, I mean, they got to be in a like four goals in a month.
Yeah,
he's not going to do that.
Yeah, if he scores four goals in the next 30 days.
He's got 30 days to score four goals, or else Andrew has to grow a Tom Selleck mustache.
Already done.
Damn it.
Then I should shave my Tom Selleck mustache.
Perish the thought. No, what are the stakes?
That's all we established. That $5.
You're right.
I will send you $5 regular mail, and you know,
fair.
I hope it makes it to you.
Fair.
Some U.S. news.
All right. Well, hopefully, I will remember next week or by mid-January that I have bet $5 on a Rune of Dawn or four.
You know.
Honestly, I think that's going to happen.
You mean you've lost $5 on Aruna Dindon?
Hey, I think Aruna Dindon scored a hat trick, or at least a brace earlier this season. So, you know.
he missed another penalty this weekend.
He misses a lot of penalties. I mean,
he might just be gearing up to make penalties this weekend.
You're right.
Exactly. Those are always tough situations.
Playing penalties. Percentages.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I feel pretty confident about that. Look at that. If he pulls one more performance like he had against Wigan, hat trick, and his next game against – who is their next game against? Their next game is against Sunderland. That's doable. And then
– Sunderland is way better than they are.
Boy, all of a sudden, I got to say, this is not looking quite as promising as I'd hoped, because they do have to play Chelsea and Liverpool. Actually, if it's Liverpool, he's probably going
to
score.
Yeah, this is Dindon snatching a goal. This doesn't have to mean Portsmouth winning.
Right, exactly. And I mean, the way Liverpool is playing right now, I think anybody could score against him.
And you've
got
the advantage of the compact holiday fixture list.
Right, exactly.
I mean, anything that gets more Dindon on the – but then he's going to have to rest some.
Well, maybe. Maybe he'll just play through the tiredness.
I think there are seven games between now and the middle of January for Aruna Dindon to score
four goals.
If he can bag goals against Sunderland, West Ham, Fulham, and Birmingham, which I think are all very doable.
Fulham is like the best defensive team in the league this season.
Yeah, well,
nobody scores on them.
Well, then you could say he just has to score one in the games out of Liverpool and Chelsea and Fulham.
And Arsenal. And Fulham. They have a tough run, Portsmouth, over the next couple of weeks. This is going to be a hard time for them.
You're going to owe me $5.
Yeah, probably so. Probably so.
All right, well, I think we should conclude with the wager.
Yes.
All right. Well, you gents have a lovely evening. We will be back sometime next week, probably, to talk about some other stuff that happened and stuff.
Play us out, Jellycat.